We need a region-wide process for the Middle East that brings in all countries to establish precisely this zone free of nuclear weapons, but also all classes of weapons of mass destruction. Yes, the current context may not be opportune for that approach, but I think it doesn't detract from the urgency of the problem, because if it is the case that the Middle East is at a tipping point whereby it can become a fully nuclearized region, then I think it reinforces the urgency of trying to devise that approach.
Mit dem Politikwissenschaftler Karim Haggag aus Kairo spreche ich über die Notwendigkeit eines regionalen Prozesses im Nahen Osten, der alle Länder einbezieht, um eine Zone frei von Atomwaffen und anderen Massenvernichtungswaffen zu schaffen. Außerdem geht es um die wachsende Präsenz von Russland, China und den USA vor Ägyptens Küste und warum sich die Krisen der Region nicht militärisch lösen lassen. Die Aufmerksamkeit lag in den letzten Monaten stark auf Gaza und nun auf Syrien. Wie sehr diese Konflikte mit dem Machtkampf um das Rote Meer zusammenhängen, besprechen wir in dieser Folge. Herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Folge des Zenit-Podcasts. Mein Name ist Josephine Herrmann. Es gibt Neuigkeiten. Das neue Zenit-Magazin ist da. Unser Thema ist dieses Mal der Machtkampf um das Rote Meer. Dieses Podcast-Interview könnt ihr auch in unserer neuen Ausgabe nachlesen. Seine einzigartige Beschaffenheit ist Fluch und Segen des Roten Meeres. Nadelöhr des Welthandels, geostrategische Bruchlinie, Biosphäre von großer Artenvielfalt und ein lebendiger Kulturraum, in dem sich die ältesten bekannten Zivilisationen buchstäblich die Klinke in die Hand gegeben haben. Im Dossier der neuen Ausgabe widmen wir uns dem Geschehen in und um das Rote Meer sowie dessen geopolitischen Zusammenhängen. Wer heute einen Container von Hamburg nach Dubai verschickt, wird feststellen, dass das deutlich länger dauert als früher und deutlich teurer geworden ist. Die seit über einem Jahr unaufhörlich voranschreitende Zerstörung des Gazastreifens und der Kriegseintritt der Houthi-Miliz im Jemen haben die Spannung in der gefährlichen Passage durch den Suezkanal und das Tor der Tränen verschärft. Die Anrainer des Roten Meeres sind zudem von gleich vier kriegerischen Konflikten betroffen: Äthiopien, Sudan, Jemen und Somalia. Welt- und Regionalmächte ringen dort um Einfluss und verschärfen diese Zustände mitunter sogar. Durch das Rote Meer verläuft auch die weltweit am stärksten frequentierte Route von Migranten, die jedes Risiko eingehen, um vom Westen in die reichen Golfstaaten zu gelangen. Im neuen Zenit-Magazin beleuchten wir die politischen Hintergründe und führen mit Reportagen durch das, was eine Region kulturell verbindet, die von der Wissenschaft noch viel zu häufig unterteilt wird, in ein linkes afrikanisches und ein rechtes arabisches Ufer. Es ist eine Welt, die für den Aufstieg Europas einst von großer, wenngleich heute oft verkannter Bedeutung war. Karim Haggag, langjähriger ägyptischer Diplomat und Professor für Politikwissenschaft an der American University in Kairo, warnt, dass das Rote Meer zunehmend zur Bühne globaler Machtkonkurrenz und wachsender geopolitischer Spannungen wird. Die Aufmerksamkeit der letzten Monate richtete sich stark auf Gaza und aktuell auf Syrien. In dieser Folge beleuchten wir, wie diese Konflikte mit dem Machtkampf um das Rote Meer und dessen geopolitische Dynamiken zusammenhängen. Wie reagiert Ägypten auf die Herausforderungen in einer so instabilen Region? Und wie beeinflussen Konflikte in Somalia, dem Jemen oder Sudan die Sicherheit? Ein Gespräch über die wichtigste Veränderung in diesem Konfliktraum und wie eine umfassende Abrüstung in der Region gelingen könnte. The Red Sea is a pivotal maritime corridor linking the Mediterranean Sea to the Indian Ocean via the Suez Canal. Approximately 10% of the global trade passes through this route. It's of great importance for oil and gas exports from the Middle East to Europe and beyond. Can you tell me more about how the Red Sea is gaining increasing importance on the global geopolitical stage?
Well, the Red Sea has always been a pivotal region geopolitically. As you mentioned, it's a major route for maritime commerce. It is bounded on both sides, north and south, by two of the most important maritime choke points, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait in the south and the Suez Canal in the north. And as you mentioned, it's a major route for maritime commerce, in addition to being a major energy corridor. So roughly 30% of all seaborne oil it passes through the Red Sea. I think what the major transformation that happened, the major strategic trend that we've seen over the last 10 years is that the region's conflicts have spilled over into the maritime space. So before, many of the region's conflicts were insulated from the maritime domain. So the conflicts in Ethiopia, in Somalia, or in the Horn of Africa in general, in Sudan, in Yemen, these didn't really affect the maritime space related to the Red Sea. Recently, however, we've seen how these conflicts have spilled over in a major way into the maritime domain. So we see that, of course, with regards to the conflict in Yemen, where we have the initiation of by the Houthis of attacks against maritime shipping related to the conflict in Gaza. We see that with respect to the cluster of conflicts around the Horn of Africa that are increasingly focused on the maritime domain, with competition over access to the sea, for example, by Ethiopia, competition with respect to access for basing rights, for port rights. So these conflicts are spilling over more and more into the maritime domain. With that, the conflicts in the region have become increasingly globalized. So the Red Sea has been transformed into an arena for great power competition, but also regional power competition. And that, I think, has been the major transformation, making the Red Sea increasingly important as an arena of geopolitical competition.
Das Rote Meer ist eine strategisch wichtige Region und zentrale Handelsroute, die von zwei bedeutenden maritimen Engpässen begrenzt wird. Der Straße von Bab el-Mandab im Süden und dem Suezkanal im Norden. Während frühere Konflikte in der Region oft vom maritimen Bereich getrennt waren, hat sich dies geändert. Rivalitäten um Marinestützpunkte und der Zugang zum Meer, etwa durch Äthiopien, haben zugenommen. Das Rote Meer ist heute ein Schauplatz globaler und regionaler Machtkonkurrenz. Although piracy levels have decreased in recent years, the Red Sea remains vulnerable. It is also a transit route for human trafficking from Africa to the Middle East and further. What is Egypt's role in managing security, and how is Egypt managing the rising influence of external powers?
Yes, so Egypt's approach with respect to the Red Sea has always been one that tries to support and reinforce stability in the region. So Egypt has taken a very non-interventionist approach with regards to conflicts in the region, and its whole foreign policy approach is based on preserving the territorial integrity of states, non-interference in the domestic affairs of states, the peaceful resolution of conflicts. So Egypt has really adopted a cooperative approach with respect to organizing security in the region. It's partnered with Saudi Arabia to organize the Red Sea Cooperation Council. So that is meant to be a regional body bringing all of the littoral states that border the Red Sea in one forum for addressing the security challenges facing the region. So this has been very much Egypt's approach. Egypt more recently has taken a more activist posture with respect to the region's security challenges. And this has been driven by the fact that Egypt's own security interests have become more and more intertwined with the region's changing security dynamics. You see that most clearly with respect to Somalia, where Egypt is now increasingly partnering with the legitimate government in Somalia and countries like Eritrea, where we see increasing security coordination. Egypt has offered to replace the Ethiopian peacekeeping contingent in Somalia with its own peacekeepers. And that offer has been accepted by the legitimate government in Somalia. But again, all of this is really an attempt to bolster security and stability in the region, focused on a cooperative approach as opposed to a confrontational approach. So that has really been the thrust of Egypt's approach. The Red Sea Cooperation Council that has been formed in the partnership with Egypt and Saudi Arabia has unfortunately been dormant. Egypt is trying to revive that framework for regional cooperation, because the challenges really that the security challenges facing the region are highly complex. They are highly intertwined. We are talking about not just regional conflicts, but the intersection of these conflicts with many human security challenges. We are talking about environmental degradation. We are talking about food insecurity. We are talking about energy insecurity. So all of these really require a very robust cooperative approach. And that is the direction that Egypt hopefully wants to take with respect to organizing security in the Red Sea.
Ägypten setzt im Roten Meer auf Stabilität, Kooperation und friedliche Konfliktlösung. Das Land arbeitet mit Saudi-Arabien am Red Sea Cooperation Council und stärkt Sicherheitsbeziehungen, etwa mit Somalia und Eritrea. Angesichts komplexer Herausforderungen wie Umweltzerstörung, Hunger und Nahrungsmittelunsicherheit fordert Ägypten einen kooperativen Ansatz für regionale Sicherheit. And how do you evaluate the influence of China, the U.S. and Russia in the region?
So China, Russia, and the United States, the fact that we see a much more concerted geopolitical focus on the part of these powers with respect to the Red Sea, this, of course, highlights the centrality of the Red Sea as a major arena for global great power competition. But unlike perhaps other powers, Egypt does not see the increasing presence of these states in the Red Sea as a major source of threat or even competition, because again, Egypt does not look at its relationships in the Red Sea in adversarial terms. So Egypt has a very cooperative relationship with China. China, of course, established its thus far only overseas base outside of China in Djibouti. So one of the very early instances of a great power establishing a military presence in the Red Sea. Similarly, it has a very cooperative approach with regards to Russia. Russia has attempted to gain access, port access and base access in the Red Sea, primarily through Sudan. That has not transpired as of yet. And Egypt, of course, has a long-standing security relationship with the United States. And interestingly, just as an example reflecting Egypt's non-interventionist approach with regards to the region's security, with regards to the Houthi attacks against maritime shipping in the Red Sea, Egypt was perhaps the most affected country by this development because it drastically reduced maritime shipping through the Suez Canal by almost 40%. The revenues accrued by Egypt from this traffic dropped by over 50%. So Egypt was a major country that was affected. However, Egypt refused to join the U.S.-led military operation against the Houthis in Yemen, Operation Prosperity Guardian, even though it was one of the most affected countries by this development. Primarily out of the conviction that there are no military solutions to these conflicts. So Egypt opted for a more negotiated approach, focused on establishing a ceasefire in Gaza as a way to establish a region-wide ceasefire that would include other conflict arenas, primarily Yemen, but also Lebanon, after the spillover of the Gaza conflict into Lebanon. So that, I think, is a very recent and very stark example of Egypt's approach.
China, Russland und die USA richten ihren geopolitischen Fokus verstärkt auf das Rote Meer. Ägypten sieht deren Präsenz jedoch nicht als Bedrohung und pflegt kooperative Beziehungen, insbesondere zu China und Russland. Mit den USA besteht eine langjährige Sicherheitskooperation. Doch Ägypten lehnt militärische Lösungen wie die US-Operation im Jemen ab und setzt auf Verhandlungen für regionale Waffenstillstände, so Karim Haggag. Die Region steht vor großen Herausforderungen, wie die eskalierenden Konflikte im Jemen und am Horn von Afrika, dem Bürgerkrieg im Sudan und humanitäre Krisen durch Flüchtlingsströme. Externe Akteure wie Äthiopien, Iran und die Türkei verschärfen die Lage zusätzlich. The Middle East presents a unique and challenging environment for nuclear non-proliferation due to historical rivalries, security dilemmas, and the presence of both state and non-state actors with different nuclear capabilities and ambitions. What are the current risks of nuclear proliferation in the Middle East? And how do you assess the situation with Israel's nuclear status, Iran's nuclear ambitions, and the potential for a regional arms race?
Yes, so unfortunately, the Middle East region has been one of the most one of the regions most prone to proliferation. We've seen this with respect to Israel's acquisition of a military nuclear capability. In fact, the first state to proliferate outside of the five established nuclear weapon states. So we've already seen one state in the region go nuclear, crossing the threshold at the end of the 1960s. Since then, we've had instances of proliferation. We've seen this in Iraq, we've seen this in Syria, we've seen this in Libya, and of course now we are seeing it in Iran. And unfortunately, what has reinforced this trend is the fact that the Middle East has not had a viable arms control or disarmament process for decades. Since Egypt launched an initiative during the beginning of the 1990s to establish a zone free of all weapons of mass destruction to deal with this problem comprehensively, unfortunately, because of Israel's refusal to join this process, we have not had a viable arms control framework for the region for decades now. Now what we are seeing may be close to a tipping point. Iran is now what is usually termed as a threshold nuclear state. So a state that has the knowledge and capabilities to cross the nuclear threshold if it takes a position to do so. We've also seen very troubling hedging dynamics on the part of other states in the region who also express an intent to follow or to match Iran's capabilities. And we've also seen a very troubling trend of the nuclearization of deterrence relationships. So now Iran is very openly invoking the threat of going nuclear if it is subject to a military attack by either Israel or the United States. So all of these are converging to produce what may be a tipping point where we transition into a nuclearized Middle East. And that, I think, just highlights the urgency of going back or trying to devise a viable arms control process for the region.
Der Nahe Osten ist stark von nuklearer Proliferation geprägt, angefangen mit Israels Atomprogramm in den 1960er Jahren. Länder wie Irak, Syrien, Libyen und aktuell Iran treiben diese Entwicklung voran. Seit Jahrzehnten fehlt ein effektiver Abrüstungsprozess. Ägyptens Initiative für eine waffenfreie Zone scheiterte an Israels Ablehnung. Der Iran gilt als Schwellenstaat und droht offen mit Nuklearwaffen bei Angriffen durch Israel oder die USA. Andere Staaten könnten dem Iran folgen, was die Region an einen kritischen Wendepunkt bringt und die Notwendigkeit für Abrüstung verstärkt, warnt Karim Haggag. Denken wir an eine Wiederbelebung des Atomabkommens oder die Aushandlung neuer Nuklearvereinbarungen. Wie tragfähig sind Rüstungskontrollrahmen wie die atomwaffenfreie Zone im Nahen Osten angesichts der aktuellen geopolitischen Landschaft? Reviving the JCPOA or negotiating new agreements with stricter enforcement and broader participation could help curb Iran's nuclear program. What are your thoughts on that? And how viable are arms control frameworks such as a Middle East nuclear weapon-free zone in the current geopolitical climate?
So the JCPOA was, I think, reflective of what has been an ad hoc approach to deal with the region's non-proliferation problem. The JCPOA was designed to deal with the problem of Iran's nuclear capabilities. It was a highly complex agreement. And of course, we've had the very unfortunate development of the United States withdrawing from this agreement in 2018 as a result of a decision by the Trump administration. But it's important to highlight that the JCPOA only dealt with one problem of proliferation in the region. And Egypt has always reinforced the point that you cannot deal with the proliferation problem in an ad hoc way when it comes to the Middle East. So we can't just deal with the Iran problem alone, or the Iraq problem alone, or the Syria problem alone. We need a comprehensive approach that brings in all countries of the region in an arms control process to establish a situation of mutual security for countries of the region as a whole. So unfortunately, going back to the JCPOA or a revised version of the JCPOA will not be enough. We need a region-wide process for the Middle East that brings in all countries to establish precisely this zone free of nuclear weapons, but also all classes of weapons of mass destruction. Yes, the current context may not be opportune for that approach, but I think it doesn't detract from the urgency of the problem, because if it is the case that the Middle East is at a tipping point whereby it can become a fully nuclearized region, then I think it reinforces the urgency of trying to devise that approach, hopefully when the current crisis passes.
Der JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, war ein kurzfristiger Ansatz, der nur Irans Atomprogramm betraf. Nach dem US-Ausstieg 2018 verschärfte sich die Lage. Ägypten fordert stattdessen einen umfassenden regionalen Prozess, der alle Länder und Massenvernichtungswaffen einbezieht. Dies sei angesichts der drohenden nuklearen Eskalation im Nahen Osten dringend notwendig, meint Karim Haggag. What future scenarios do you foresee in terms of Red Sea security and the broader geopolitical landscape in the Middle East?
With regards to Red Sea security, I think there needs to be an emphasis or an approach on two levels. I think there needs to be first a very concerted regional and international approach to address the region's conflicts. So for all of the conflicts that have been ongoing in the Red Sea region, Sudan, Somalia, Ethiopia, with respect to the war with Tigray, and of course Yemen, all of these conflicts have been some of the deadliest so far with respect to the 21st century. So if we look at Yemen and Sudan, for example, these have produced some of the most horrific humanitarian toll in terms of casualties, in terms of displacement, in terms of violations of international humanitarian law. But unfortunately, we have not seen a very concerted, robust conflict resolution process adopted by the international community and also regional states to try and settle these conflicts. The mediation efforts have been halting and for the most part weak and inconsistent. So we need a much more concerted effort to address these specific conflicts, to find a viable settlement for these conflicts, not just mitigate the conflicts, but to actually settle the core issues at the heart of these conflicts. And secondly, we need to revive this cooperative framework for organizing security for the region. So there is a framework in place in the form of the Red Sea Cooperation Council. I think that needs a much more concerted political will on the part of countries of the Red Sea to actually invest in the success of that process. With respect to the broader Middle East, I think we are unfortunately at a very dangerous moment. I think once this current conflict once this current crisis is over, I think we need to rethink many of the fundamentals by which we have approached security in the region. I think the international community, but also countries of the Middle East, have left many issues unresolved. The Palestinian issue has been without a peace process now for almost 20 years. The problem of militarization of the region, as we've been discussing, not only with unconventional weapons, but also with conventional armaments. This is one of the most highly militarized regions of the world, with spending on armaments reaching record levels. And I think we fundamentally need to think very hard about how we can devise a cooperative approach to deal with insecurities in the region. So we have no OSCE-like framework for the Middle East, you know, a framework that can bring Arab countries, but also non-Arab Middle East countries to the table to discuss issues of security, to discuss issues of confidence building, to discuss issues of arms control and disarmament. So that needs, I think, a very hard rethink. Hopefully, the current crisis will pass without the region degenerating into a complete breakdown of security, resulting in an all-out regional conflict. But I think that that prospect alone reinforces the urgency of rethinking these fundamentals moving forward.
Laut Karim Haggag erfordert die Sicherheit im Roten Meer zwei Ansätze. Erstens müssen regionale und internationale Akteure entschlossener gegen Konflikte wie im Sudan, Somalia, Äthiopien und Jemen vorgehen. Diese gehören zu den schlimmsten humanitären Krisen des 21. Jahrhunderts. Bisher waren Vermittlungsbemühungen schwach. Es braucht Lösungen für die Konfliktursachen, nicht nur für Symptombekämpfung. Zweitens müssen die regionale Zusammenarbeit, etwa durch den Red Sea Cooperation Council, wiederbelebt werden, unterstützt von mehr politischem Willen der Anrainerstaaten. Ungelöste Konflikte wie die Palästina-Frage verschärfen die Unsicherheit. Eine Plattform für Dialog und Rüstungskontrolle sei dringend notwendig, um einen regionalen Kollaps zu verhindern. What gives you hope?
What gives hope is, I think, the countries and peoples of the region have seen what a real breakdown looks like. We've seen that in Gaza, we've seen that in Lebanon, we've seen that with the conflicts surrounding the Red Sea. And hopefully the very horror of what the region can look like without addressing these conflicts will prompt states to pull back from the brink.
Das war eine neue Folge unseres Zenit-Podcasts. Das Interview findet ihr auch im neuen Zenit-Magazin. Schreibt uns gerne, wie ihr die Episode findet und was ihr denkt. Abonniert uns, bewertet uns, teilt gerne auch den Podcast. Und dann hören wir uns bald wieder. Danke und bis bald.